Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
How'd it go?
We got one out of two of them motherfuckers, you know?
You mean you motherfuckers come strolling in here all walking tall and shit?
Look, we out, man. I'm saying, man, we was blazing on them dudes, man. You know what I'm saying? Just got in the heat, man. We was blazing, though. It was late.
All right. Relax, man. I already heard. Go sit down. I'm not tweaking behind none of this. That's one less motherfucker that's breathing than was yesterday. You know what I'm saying? So we all good. But I'm surprised with you, though, man. Shit didn't get by you back when.
Well, my man's fault, man. I unloaded on the younger too soon, man. Gave him enough room to buck and run, man. I fucked that shit up myself, you know.
Hold on. It's on me. I had that kid in my sights. Close enough to take off his Kango and half his dome with it. Couldn't squeeze the trigger. Couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
Wasn't in me, I guess. You know, whatever it is in you that lets you flow like you flow and do that thing, it ain't in me no more.
Alright. So you done soldiering, but you ain't done. Could use you for what you got in your head. We're going to put you on a corner. You could be inside.
Oh, man. I ain't making myself clear. The game ain't in me no more. None of it.
But you ain't done shit else. You know what I'm saying? So what you gonna do?
I don't know. But it can't be this.
All right, then. We straight.
B, he's a man in his time, you know?
Yeah. He a man today. He a man.
Thank you. because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you, sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing as you're driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build little shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them, and there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarion Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway. And it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it. And said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
My home is not for sale. And if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe.
What Jim Salit is talking about is the city of Lakewood, Ohio, taking his house, his home, through eminent domain to make way for a high-priced condo that will pay the city more in taxes than he and his wife Joanne do. And he says he's not going to take it lying down.
It's a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
I'm Mike Wallace.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Ed Bradley.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl. Those stories and Andy Rooney tonight on 60 Minutes.
Just about everyone knows that under a process called eminent domain, the government can and does seize private property for public use to build a road or a courthouse. But did you know the government can also seize your land for private use if they can prove that doing it will serve what is called the public good? Cities across the country have been using eminent domain to force people off their land so that private developers can build more expensive homes and offices, which will pay more in property taxes than the buildings they are replacing. Under eminent domain, the government buys your property, paying you what is determined to be fair market value. But now, people who don't want to sell their homes at any price just to see their land go to another private owner are fighting back.
The bottom line is, this is morally wrong, what they're doing here. This is our home, and we're going to stay here, and I'm going to fight them tooth and nail. I've just begun to fight.
Jim and Joanne Salit are refusing to sell the home they've lived in for 38 years in a quiet neighborhood of single-family houses in Lakewood, Ohio, just outside Cleveland. The city of Lakewood is trying to use eminent domain to force the Salits out to make way for more expensive condominiums. But the Salits are in effect telling the town, hell no, they won't go.
We talked about this when we were dating. I used to point to the houses and say, Joanne, one of these days we're going to have one of these houses. And I meant it. And I worked hard.
What'd you do?
I worked in the pharmaceutical industry. And we worked very hard for this. And paid it off, and we said, oh, we've got it. We paid off our home. I retired, and now we're going to spend the rest of our days here and pass this on to our children.
But Lakewood's mayor, Madeline Kane, has other plans. She wants to tear down the Salit's home, plus 55 homes around it, along with four apartment buildings and more than a dozen businesses, so that private developers can build high-priced condominiums and a high-end shopping mall, and thus raise Lakewood's property tax base.
This is a project.
The mayor told us she sought out a developer for the project because Lakewood's aging tax base has been shrinking and the city simply needs more money.
This is about Lakewood's future. Lakewood cannot survive without a strengthened tax base. Is it right to consider this a public good? Absolutely.
What you're saying effectively is that the Salit's neighborhood has to be sacrificed for the greater good of the city of Lakewood.
I guess I'm saying that that neighborhood is being asked to, and it's difficult and it's unfortunate that they are being asked to give up their home.
They want this whole area because of the view of the park.
Well, it's a beautiful view.
It is an awesome view. They know it's gorgeous, and they want it. It's that simple.
This whole area is called Scenic Park, but that's the problem. Because it is so scenic, it's a prime place to build upscale condominiums. With great views over the Rocky River, those condos will be a cinch to sell.
But the condos can't go up unless the city can remove the Solites and their neighbors through eminent domain. And to legally invoke eminent domain, the city had to certify that this scenic park area is really, quote, blighted.
We're not blighted. This is an area that we absolutely love. It's a close-knit, beautiful neighborhood. It's what America's all about. And, Mike, you don't know how humiliating this is to have people tell you you live in a blighted area and how degrading this is.
You're the mayor. You know the place. Tell me what is blighted about that area.
The term blighted is a statutory word. It is. It really doesn't have a lot to do with whether or not your home is painted. It is a legal statutory term.
Meaning?
That is used to describe an area. And the question is whether or not that area can be used for a higher and better use.
What does that mean, a higher and better use? What's higher and better than a home?
The term blight is used to describe whether or not the structures generally in an area meet today's standards.
And it's the city that sets those standards. So Lakewood set a standard for blight that would include most of the homes in the neighborhood. A home could be considered blighted if it doesn't have the following.
3 bedrooms, 2 baths, an attached 2-car garage, and central air. Now, this community is over 100 years old. Who has all those things?
You mean it's blighted if it doesn't have 3 bedrooms?
Those things I just told you. That's the criteria. And it's ridiculous.
You don't have central air?
No, and we don't need it because of the air. We always have a breeze.
Sure.
Right off Lake Erie, the breeze comes right through here all the time. We counted all the attached garages in Lakewood. There's 20 in the whole city.
We counted 20.
And by the way, we got up at a meeting and told the mayor and all 7 council members their houses are blighted according to this criteria.
My understanding is that using the criteria that are in place, more than 90% of the houses in Lakewood could be deemed blighted, including the houses of the mayor and of every one of the city council members. True? Do you have 2 bathrooms?
No.
Blight. 2-car garage?
No.
Blight. Is the garage attached?
No.
Blight. And your lot size is under 5,000 square feet?
Oh, well under.
You've called that area a cute little neighborhood. You didn't call it a cute little blighted neighborhood. I mean, you and I know that it's not a blighted neighborhood.
I would never personally walk that neighborhood and indicate that that neighborhood is not attractive or... I mean, I would never say that.
It's a cute little neighborhood.
It is a cute little neighborhood. You'll get me to say it on the record. It is a cute little neighborhood.
Cute, maybe, but without those new condos, it won't produce enough property taxes to satisfy the mayor and the city council.
That's no excuse for taking my home. My
home.
Home is not for sale, and if my home isn't safe, nobody's home is safe in the whole country, not only Ohio, but this is rampant all over the country. It's like a plague.
This is a nationwide epidemic. We have documented more than 10,000 instances of government taking property from one person to give it to another in just the last 5 years.
Dana Berliner and Scott Bullock are attorneys at a libertarian nonprofit group called the Institute for Justice, which has filed suit on behalf of the Solites against the city of Lakewood. They claim that taking private property this way is unconstitutional.
It is fundamentally wrong and contrary to the Constitution for the government to take property from one private owner and hand it over to another private owner just because the government thinks that person is going to make more productive use of the land.
Everyone knows that property can be taken for a road, but nobody thinks that property can be taken to give it to their neighbor or the large business down the street for their economic benefit. People are shocked when they hear that this is going on around the country.
And it's not just people's homes that are the targets in these eminent domain cases. The Institute for Justice has also filed suit against the city of Mesa, Arizona, to save Randy Bailey's brake repair shop, the shop he got from his father and hopes someday to pass on to his son. The city of Mesa, citing the need for redevelopment, is trying to force Bailey to relocate to make way for an Ace Hardware store that would look better and pay more taxes.
Redevelopment to me is, work with the existing people there and redevelop.
Right.
Not, you get out, we're bringing this guy in.
Bailey's Brake Service has been on this corner for more than 30 years.
In Mesa, this is the corner, Main Street and Country Club. There's not a better corner in this city.
And business has been pretty good down the years?
Business has been awesome.
Now, what used to be in all of this property? I mean, everything else has disappeared.
The city come in and got immediate possession and started demolishing it, making it dirt.
The city has made dirt out of 3 restaurants and 4 businesses that once stood on this 5-acre lot.
And it's not just business properties that they're doing this on. You know, they wiped out 8 people's homes over here. You know, your home ain't even safe.
Bailey told us his neighbors let the city buy them out, but he's refusing to sell.
I'm standing in their way. I'm their thorn in their side.
A thorn in the side of Ken Linhart, who owns the Ace Hardware store a few blocks away. Linhart wants a much bigger store. He could have negotiated with Bailey, but instead, he convinced the city of Mesa to try to buy Bailey's land through eminent domain and then sell it to him.
The city of Mesa wants to move Mr. Bailey about a block away, and from what I understand, it's going to be a new building, new equipment, moving expenses, and everything set up for him. I don't see how Mr. Bailey's going to get hurt.
You can't replace a business in the same location. This place was built in 1952 as a breaking front end shop. I don't care where you move into City Mesa, it would never be the same.
So Bailey went to Linhart looking for a way to stay on his corner.
I tried to go to him and see if we couldn't work something out on this. And he told me, no, there ain't room for you there. We're going to let the city just take care of you.
Did you ever sit down and try to negotiate with him?
No, I never did.
Redevelopment seems to me to make obvious good sense. But the right of eminent domain to take one man's private property, Randy Bailey, to give it, in effect, to Ken Linhart for his private property.
It happens all over the country. Practically any town you want to go to, they're redeveloping their town centers.
Right.
Now, are we going to sit in Mesa, Arizona, and have our town center decay? As a citizen of Mesa, I don't want that to happen.
If I'd had a for sale sign out there, it'd been a whole different deal. And for them to come in and tell me how much my property is worth and for me to get out because they're bringing in somebody else when I own the land is unfounded to me. It don't even sound like the United States.
And this isn't happening just in small towns. Right here in New York City, a few blocks away from Times Square, New York State has forced a man to sell land on that corner over there that his family had owned for more than 100 years. And what's going up instead? A courthouse? A school? Nope. The new headquarters of the New York Times.
It seems the world's most prestigious newspaper wants to build a new home on this block. But Stratford Wallace and the block's other property owners did not want to sell. Wallace told us the newspaper never tried to negotiate with him. Instead, the Times teamed up with a major real estate developer, and together they convinced the state to use eminent domain to force Wallace out by declaring the block blighted.
I challenge them. This is not blighted property, nor is this property over here blighted.
But New York State Supreme Court disagreed. The court ruled that the newspaper's new headquarters would eliminate blight, and that even though a private entity, the New York Times, is the main beneficiary, improving the block would benefit the public. New York Times executives would not talk to us about it on camera. Back in Lakewood, Ohio, Jim and Joanne Salid are still waiting for their court decision. Most of their neighbors have agreed to sell if the project goes ahead, but the Salids plus a dozen others are hanging tough.
I thought I bought this place, but I guess I just leased it until the city wants it. That's what makes me very angry. This is my dream home, and I'm going to fight for it.
Now the fight is moving.
All right. Today's podcast is titled What Amish Parents Teach Their Kids, Children. And we have back today Albert Lee, but we have another guest before we bring him on. And in that story, matter of fact, if you want to see the visual of this, and that story is 40, that what you just heard, that's at least 42 years old. 42 years old. And it's still going on today. And this program that we're doing today is a continuation of the podcast that we had on Tuesday, which we're going to touch on generational wealth and things of that nature, which include gentrification. Now, if you can go to YouTube and put in 60 minutes eminent domain, you'll see the visual to the audio that I just played. Now, everybody that was interviewed in that story, and Mike Wallace covered the Salitz, a white family, Randy Bailey in Mesa, Arizona, a white man, and then the New York Times and was a white gentleman as well. Those are three examples of white folks do get gentrified too. Now, there's a group of people, probably two groups of people at least, that you never hear about their neighborhoods getting gentrified or they're losing their house out to somebody who wants it for private industry. And that would be the Amish and the Mennonites. So thus today's podcast is titled, What Do the Amish and the Mennonites Teach Their Children? Now, we touched on some of this the other day, but we're going to go more into detail today. Because, once again, that audio that you just heard is 42 years old, at least. And if you're a parent, grandparent, or great-grandparent, you might want to have that conversation with your children on generational wealth, plus train them on how to maintain, multiply, and move forward what you've built to the next generation and the next generation. You don't want to wait until your kids are 42. You want to have this conversation with them as early as possible. You know, 8, 9, if they're old enough to go to school, you can start baby feeding them on, you know, even with this cutting the grass, you know, it's estate planning. Because by the time your children, to be honest about it, by the time they're 21, it might be too late. If they don't know how to protect or maintain the property, the family house, which is also called the ancestral house. See, mama's house and daddy's house, or grandma's house and grandpa's house, that's ancestral property. So on a 60 minutes thing, and with an Amish and Mennonite set up shop, is very important. They basically set up shop in rural areas. But we'll go more into details of that with Albert Lee in a little bit. Who I want to bring on first is Delmar America, and he's been on here at least once before. And Delmar has a podcast here on Blog Talk, and he's got at least, I think, 14 in the archives. So good morning, Delmar. Your mic's open.
Yes, good morning. Okay. My mic was up. Sorry about that.
No problem. Delmar, tell us about your podcast and how can we listen to it?
Okay, we are Fair Passion, Showtime, the union. And we are focusing on the family. At the same time, we are on a campaign to create a nation's anthem prayer. The ministry is business ministry, and I phrase it that way both ways because you can read left to right or right to left. I learned that. And so what we're focusing on, we believe that the family dysfunctional, particularly in this country, part of the world, and recognizing that we saw that all of humanity was started with family. And the basic element of family is male, female, sperm, and egg. That's it. And that's the only way it's going to keep going, no matter what anybody else says, except cloning and other kind of artificial. But the family that we know that God created when he breathed into man the breath of life and set up the reproductive system between male and female, that's the way it's done. But from the family come the clan, or another phrase, the nations. And that is the order, the way which God has done everything to deal with resetting the humanity that he created during this phase of creation. We call it the terrestrial part of it, you know, on this planet. So we believe that the family is that unit, and we believe that what's happening is pretty much a proof text because of the shattering of the family, the dysfunction of the family, even when people are living in the same house. I call those connections. Oftentimes, they're not related. They're just using the house as a facility for feeding and housing. They go in there, and each brother has his own private everything. In fact, how many families you know that actually have dinner together at the table? Everybody has their own room, their own cell phone, on TV, on everything. We just go in and get our stuff and go our separate ways. So the family has been thrown aside, and I confess even in the religious church community, the church has forsaken the family. It's not even a topic of study or understanding. And therefore, we've chosen this as a need, a focus to, again, we have several points that we bring out on our podcast. And as L.A. was saying, we have several on. Let me get right to how to reach them, what my address is. It is simply Blog Talk. And that's a unique word if you're not used to it, but it's the same one here. .com, and you put /, and my name, and it's spelled Delmar, D-E-L-M-A-R, America, and that's with two A's, that's A-A-M-A-R-I-C-A. And that's all. That's simple. Blog Talk
Radio. Now, Delmar, do you know the call-in number? Because people can call in and listen in as well.
Call in number. Let me share that real quick while I'm on here. I'm glad you remind me of that. I wasn't thinking about that as part of my sharing here. And I thought I had that memorized, but, you know, sometimes you ask people at my point to think about something, that's when the mind seems to go blank. Like, what are you talking about? Call me what? And forgive me a second here to...
Sure.
Get what I'm putting on here. I'm in a different location perhaps than where I should be. But the call-in number, again, now I'm on my cell phone. It's made sometimes you're on the cell phone, it keeps jumping to some other place you don't want it to go. So give me a second here to get it to say to act right. But as I'm doing that, again, the address is real simple, and again, the call-in number, of course, we are sharing that. And let me just, I think I can get it from this number right here. Give me 1 second here as we are going through this. There we are, I think. Okay, we at 561-999-3028. That's 561-999-3028.
Now that's on at what times you're on 6 days a week?
Yeah.
What time
Monday
of day?
That's 5 p.m. Central Standard Time. I'm sorry, not 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. 7 p.m.
Right, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time, which is 8 p.m. Eastern Time.
Right.
So you adjust for your whatever local time zone you're in. And you've got, about 14 shows in the can so far, right?
Yeah, more accurate, probably 13, because one of the 14 is a misprint. In other words, the technology would not allow it to work that week, that particular broadcast. So it shows up, but again, you can tell quickly that it's not a real broadcast because it has a time on it. It's had like 1 minute. Anyway, they are at least 13, yes. We've got 13 done.
Okay, good. So they're all archived on Blog Talk, and he's got one tonight at the stated time, so you can reach it online, or you can call in and listen and participate. So, Now you also this concept of families helping families, which we're gonna get into later with the Amish and the Mennonite with Albert Lee. Explain your view on families helping families.
Well, here again, the advantage of just recognizing the power of the unit of the family, and I stated on my teaching that the family is the first government that humanity is supposed to come through. That's government. It's not civil government with, like the national government we have, but when you understand authority and respect for authority and just say live within authority, it starts with family. That's what makes people functionally an asset to society. And when you hear of young folks who are what they call menace to society, they didn't come through
right.
Family. They didn't come through government. They don't know how to do that. And we see that so much. That's why we have so much. So anyway, so when we take a family, and we go back to God's structure, Israel was families helping family. We had 12 tribes, basically, 12 families, who were millions in collectively as a nation. Even if you look at Israel, the Israel that we know of in Palestine there, in Jerusalem, that's families. And in this country, in America, I've had occasion to serve on with the United Way on I was on a finance committee, and the gentleman who was on the committee who headed up was the director for the Jewish Federation in Memphis, Tennessee at that time. And again, but the Jews, wherever you find them, they have a family, helping family concept. They have a federation. They have some kind of unity going on. And you don't hear a whole lot about what they're doing, but you don't hear them being locked up, especially their children, as ours are. So, again, this family helping family is a model that's already been established, and it works. And like you say, when you get to the Amish people, you're going to find that same thing. Not just one family, but all of those are families, and that's what makes it such an effective system of corporate economics. Not just people coming together. It's families coming together. When you leave the family concept out, it's not just the people, it's the family structure of the people that makes it so powerful.
All right, that's how the Amish and the Mennonite operate, and others as well, but I'm thinking about, you got gangs in different parts of the country, and a lot of those people who join gangs essentially... Many of them don't have families, or the families are very, very dysfunctional. So they join a gang, and that becomes their de facto family.
They'll even use their term. That's right. the mafia, some of the most successful, powerful crime organizations, they are families, right?
That's true.
You go back and what was that TV series? What was that real successful TV series on? I forget. Just go from there. It stayed on for several seasons. The Somebodies. And everybody watched it.
Oh, the Sopranos.
But it was
The Sopranos.
Was a family.
Yeah, that's a family. You're right.
The name of a family. Right. Now, the race, of course, is Italian. But again, it wasn't, Soprano wasn't some guy. That was a family. And then
you're
look
right.
at the Godfather. What's the Godfather? What? Family.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah, the Godfather movie was
right
based
there.
All on family.
That's right.
Yep.
Family.
Right. And the Amish, which we'll get to in a few minutes with Albert Lee, the Amish and the Mennonites, their communities are basically family-based. I mean, each family, they have at least one or two family businesses, and they hire their children within the business early on. And, you know, they don't, as with the 60 Minutes piece I played, geographically they were in an area that they didn't have families, intact families where they could, you know, stand up to government or basically make government. One of the towns that I've talked about on here before, and we'll probably discuss it again today with Albert Lee, Yoder, Kansas. Yoder, and there are a lot of Yoder, Kansas, and it's a Mennonite, it's an Amish community. There are many of them around the United, well, in certain parts of the United States, but they're family-based, and they buy land, typically rural land, and set up their own townships. Or in many cases, they just keep the township going, where they have political control. Whereas in Lakewood, Ohio, which is right outside of Cleveland, Ohio, they don't have the correct family structure, particularly of the local landscape. So that's what was happening in that 60 Minutes story. So tonight, once again, it's 6 days a week, and Del Mar's on, and you've got the information. You have a particular topic for tonight?
I'm going to continue to follow. Much of what I'm doing right now is when you're building a foundation, it's just layer upon layer, layer upon layer. And so I'm constantly repeating and covering the same thing. And again, it's family and explaining this NAP campaign, this Nation's Anthem Prayer. And the key to that, of course, is understanding family. So you will hear all that I'm talking about in repetitions after repetitions. So I'll be talking about the family in the NAP campaign tonight.
Okay. All right, well, before we go to our next guest now, let me ask this. Now, there are quite a few churches all around the United States. What now, and a lot of churches or family-based businesses, the way I look at it. Like the Potter's House with T.D. Jakes. I look at that as a family-based business that he and his wife started. So they're living well. Fred Price with, the late Fred Price, his son took over the pulpit. His daughter, Angela, runs the whole thing. But Crenshaw Christian Center out of Los Angeles, that's a family-based business. Creflo Dollar and his wife, Taffy, were world changers. I mean, they're the two that started it. That's a family-based business. But it looks like, now maybe I'm seeing wrong, but it looks like those families that I just named, it seems like there's a disconnect between the pulpit and the congregation. Whereas in the Amish and Mennonite communities, everybody prospers. Any comments on that?
L.A., yes. It's not a disconnect. You know what a chasm is?
Yeah.
A gap, a void, an endless. That's how it is. There's no connection. All the money goes to the top and it stays up there. That's the difference right there. It's collected. Again, you mentioned the family. What about Osteen? His father started that. That was a family start. Same thing.
That's true. Joel Osteen, his dad
started
that.
Yeah.
Right.
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 And almost in many cases. Now, the only exception that you find is you don't find it in the original history of the Christian church. You don't find a family man started it and therefore it became a family thing. Now, to go further on the connection, God sees the whole community church as a family, his spiritual family, so the term is still there. But yeah, groups that are renowned for their mega churches do not demonstrate the same definition of family as you say as the Mennonites. It's a totally different planet. You know that what were the thing? Men are from Mars and women are from Venus, some kind of stuff like that.
Right.
We're two different
yep.
planets. That's right. Totally different.
Well, you're absolutely right on that. Okay, let me get Albert Lee in here. And today's podcast is titled "What Amish Parents Teach Their Kids," and Albert Lee is he's the author of two of the books that he's written: is "Strive to Arrive," which I believe you can get on Amazon, and then I think the first book that he wrote is titled, which I purchased. That's how I became connected with him. "How to Make Money 24 Hours a Day." So let me open up his mic. Good morning, Albert.
Good morning out there, group. How's everybody doing there?
Fine. Albert's calling in from California, so thank you, Albert, for... I know it's still early out that way.
That's right. I'm an early riser anyway, Lee. It don't make any difference. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, now, Albert, now you're the one that enlightened me on Amish economics. So for the people who have never really heard of that term, could you sort of define what Amish economics is?
Yes, that's a good point. Amish economics mean togetherness. And what I mean by togetherness is they believe in a group as one. You were discussing that to a point earlier. But they believe in no Amish should be left behind. And what I mean by that is they build houses and homes together. They run businesses through different relatives together. And I had a, like I told you before, I mentioned it before, is that I was exposed to that community by my in-laws. And Yoder, you talked about Yoder, Kansas. You need to go there if you've never been in that area. It's really, truly what Amish is about. And what I'm saying is it's about curing their own meats. Their food is practically raised on property they own. It's all a community. That's what it is. But they are very thrifty community. They thrive on we help each other. And it actually works that way. I went to one of the bakeries there as well as breakfast I had there. The bakery reminds me of my mother's cooking years ago. But, I mean, it's good cooking. Then you dealing with the meats, fresh meats. It's just amazing to see how they function. It's just a miracle. I mean, it is. It's just most people need to study that as much as they can because I personally think the Amish is the closest thing to being reality what people need to see, live, and do.
Now, Albert, the most, and people, there's more than Yoder. I'm just figuring that out.
That's right.
Because they're in different states and whatnot. But in a place like Yoder, And for people that want to look that up on Wikipedia, that's Y-O-D-E-R, Yoder, Kansas. It's got a population of about 165 people. Every business in Yoder is a family-based business. So could you go into that, Albert? And they're also in rural locations.
Yeah, that's a good point, Lee. What I noticed, too, and observed, I forgot to bring this up. I need to talk about this. Most of the homes that's built by the Mennonites and Amish people, they're big homes, real big, big homes. And the reason why they build big homes, because it's families living in the homes with families. And I was there and I observed the home at least had to be about 4,000, 5,000 square feet. And I was asking my father-in-law, I said, why so big? He said, well, they live in those all together. That's how thrifty they are. And
Elba, when you say they live all together, you're talking about generations, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
It passes on. Plus, some of the families that's here now, they living together. You know, it just depends on what type of Amish that you're looking at or talking to or dealing with. But but the bottom line is, money is kept into their community only. They very seldom spend money outside. I ordered, matter of fact, just recently I ordered when the virus first hit, like a couple of years ago, I ordered a face mask from Amish. Don't you know they make their own face masks?
Didn't know that. Well, I'm not surprised.
Yeah,
because they have a lot of them, like in Yoder. There's at least one family that they make quilts.
Yes.
That's what they do. They make quilts and bedwear.
And they're good at it. They do very well making quilts. But they do everything. I mean, like I said, the Amish population and the Mennonites, they all believe in never waste. Matter of fact, my mother-in-law, tell you a story about that, was what she always used to say. She would cook a big meal, say for instance today, and if it's not all eaten or ate, she would say you'll eat it tomorrow. And so they never wasted anything. That's why my wife right now has that mentality, to tell you the truth. Right now I can eat something and put it away. Next time I look around, it's back in front of my face again. So they were raised around those people, and they understand what it is. And my mother-in-law used to say, "Waste not, have not." You know, waste not. Okay. And so that's the thing, the way they live. And I had a great experience being back there. I was actually taken to different places where they run Amish businesses. I mean, strictly Amish business. And what I was fascinated with was the gift shops they have. They make all their gifts. If they don't, they got another community maybe around the area that supply them with their gifts. But it's never outside buying. I haven't seen it. And the thing is, what I was quite impressed with is that they have the farming equipment. Everything, the tractors and everything. Matter of fact, I was fascinated to see that they had tractors drawn by horse, like a buggy situation. And I think that goes way back, but that's telling you, do not waste. They don't believe in that. And the thing is, I think most people in your audience or whatever, whoever audience it may be, they need to study that because, see, we have Americans, people have gotten away from that. It's all about buy now, but when are you going to pay back later? And that's the catch. That's what put us in the situation we're going through worldwide, citywide, statewide, countrywide, because we have forgotten about things that we have now. We eventually will run out. What are you going to do then? And Amish people are very smart in that area. They feel they want to pass it on to their children. I don't know if anyone in the audience heard about the, I can't think of her name, but she got out of the Amish community for a few years back. And that was a big thing to the United States because she didn't want to live like that no more. She wanted to be American. And she did turn American, but then she started picking up the bad habits most Americans have. And all of a sudden I heard she wanted to go back home. I think she was 16. It's a book about it. But the point
I think I saw a video on that. Yeah, the thing about Americans on a critical mass basis, Americans are hyper-consumers.
Mm-hmm.
We consume,
that's right.
consume, but we don't produce.
There you
Whereas
go.
Whereas the Amish, they do consume, but they produce a lot more than they consume.
Yes, and they multiply, see.
Right.
They multiply, and the way, when I say multiply, Lee, I mean families, not outside. They multiply inside. Because, see, they're having children, their children having children. It just passes on the, it's like, it is a religion to a point. They have their own churches built on their property in their areas. They don't go outside for that either. And they have hand-picked ministers, and their ministers actually is Amish also. So it really is a beautiful way of keeping things in spite of what we go through out on the outside. They try to eliminate as much crime, much theft problems as possible. And you don't see that in the United States. You don't see that. It's all over.
Right.
Crime is all over.
Right. With the Amish, they've eliminated for first thing, the Amish and the Mennonite practice what I call real social security.
Yes.
Now, without the government, we're not talking about government, you won't find a social services office in the Amish community. They practice real social security, number one. Number two, they have eliminated the banking industry to a very large degree. There might be some exceptions, but when they build a house, they're not going to get an FHA or VA loan. They come together as a community and build that house together.
Well,
and these are the skills that they teach their kids.
Yeah, well, cutting in on you for a minute, Lee, what do you think, have you been hearing in media advertising about be your own bank?
I have.
Well, what do you think they're talking about? What do you think they're talking about? The Amish started that, okay? That's the idea. And it's a new twist to that now where the Americans is trying to Americanize that as be your own bank. Well, they've been their own bank all their lives. And that's what someone else is picking up, advertising as American, a dream or whatever, but it's not an American dream. It's the Amish way of living. That's what it is. And when they say your own bank, create your own bank, that's what they're talking about. The Amish has that, okay? And they never go outside. Most people don't really know on the outside or in the public what they are doing the inside because that's the way they want it, okay? They don't want to be bothered with the American way of living. And it can be sickening. It can be. For the people that don't know how to save or not thrifty, they just want to spend, like you said, and the next thing, they spend themselves out. And see, that's why we have so much bankruptcies, failures in businesses and stuff, because it's not sound on the foundation, okay? And they don't believe in taking on nothing that they don't feel comfortable with, even if they're building a house with the neighbors. They want to know what the lumber costs. They want to know all of that, see?
Right.
And that's what I admire that.
Now, another thing about the Amish and Mennonite communities, now, to my knowledge, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, they don't have any mega churches within their community. And you can find Amish and Mennonite in other parts of the world besides the United States. You got them in Central America. You got them in South America.
That's right.
You even have communities in Africa, believe it or not.
That's right.
But none of
that's
them.
Right.
Have a, to my knowledge, have a mega church. Or somebody driving a Rolls Royce.
Yeah. You know why, don't you? They don't want that exposed.
No, I'm right.
And see, they don't want to know what you, they don't want you knowing that they're wealthy or financially secure. They figured, let other people figure that out themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And see, that's the study of knowing, I want to know what they're doing. They're not going to tell me. They're not going to show me. But I want to see for my own self. That's what I went through years ago, Lee. I went through that. Because with the way they live, people laugh at them. They're driving or riding in buggies, a lot of them. But you don't necessarily have to ride in a buggy, but you need to pick up some of the ideas they live by. We would have a better world. We'd be better off. We don't do that, see? And we just keep on spending. But you know, I'll tell you, but the older ancestors we had, our parents and their parents, they basically lived like that because they didn't have a choice. You see the difference?
Right.
I know my mother, when I was growing up, she believed in canning foods and stuff like that. What do you think that comes from? Canned goods.
Yeah, my mother and grandmother did that, yeah.
What way you think that came? They actually had some of the living styles that the Amish is living and has been using for years. I mean, years, at least. And see, their stores sell what they like, not what the public like. It's what the Amish are like. They're keeping it all in the family. And your audience will never know about Amish like you do or I do if they don't study it. It's very important to know that. At least give yourself an opportunity to decide on, well, do I like this life? Have this life made me any money or saved me any money? Have I found myself in financial freedom? I don't worry about stress over paying bills and stuff. No. You got to give yourself a time to realize, I want to give this a try. I want to see if this works for me. And that's what you need to do. I mean, you can hear me talk about it or Lee talk about it, but get into it and try it yourself and see what you think about it. Because it's like a magic. It's like miracle. But it's reality. It's truly reality. And, you know, it's going to come to a time where all of the United States and the world will have to eventually revert back to that anyway. Because we're spending so much, we're going to eventually run out of money. And see, when you look at that side of the other side, the Amish, they never run out of money because they keep passing it down to the next generation. They keep their living style in check. They don't go beyond their means. And the opposite for the American people. They're constantly going beyond their means. That's why we have so many, again, bankruptcies, business failures, welfare. Personally, I mean, I have a thing about that, but I'm not getting into that subject. But the point is, your welfare should be you, yourself. If it's meant to be, it's up to me, okay? And you as well. And that's why you need to study what we're talking about, because it's catching on, like I told you the other day, Lee. They started from, what, 15,000 people to study. Now it's
right.
350, okay? Now that's telling you something, isn't it? You know what it is? It's not the Amish change. It's the people start studying about how they live. That's what's happening. And they're getting more money from the outside to learn this, to teach this, okay? So that's why they're growing, and it's going to get bigger. I can see in the next 5 or 6 years, it's going to probably be a million of them out there. It's just the idea is commercially, and people want to know about the other side, which is, they say a secret, but it's not a secret. They make it a secret, and they want to realize it as being a secret. I have friends, and I'm not mentioning any names, Mennonite, have worked in the real estate industry, own over 20-some houses, owe nothing on them. Nothing. Okay? And, you know, if they're Amish or Mennonite, you know, they don't believe in dead anyway. You know that.
Right. Right.
And so that should be a study for the anybody that really wants to be truly successful. That should be a study. I mean, I don't know why we follow these billionaires and all that, but you got to weigh in your own mind, because is that going to be what I want? Is that going to keep me out of the stress of every day trying to keep my billions or millions? Those are the things you have to weigh, too. It's always a trade-off.
Well,
you know that.
Yeah, Albert, one of the things, and you already know this, what a lot of people don't know, there are quite a few Amish and Mennonite families that they're little family businesses, and we're talking about these are businesses that overall they're not sexy. I mean, you might have an Amish family that owns a restaurant, quite a few farmers out there. The husband might have a woodworking business where he makes cabins, carports, things of that nature. And then they come together for a collective farmers market. Some of these families, and this that's not one or two, take in $5 to $10 million a year. It might not look like that because they don't drive Mercedes Benz and BMWs or Bentleys or Bugattis or nothing like that. But they take it in and they just live a very simple lifestyle.
That's how
they're able to achieve that.
That's right. They don't want you knowing that, Lee. They don't want you. They don't want the public know that you looking at.
I haven't run across. I've looked for books written by Amish and Mennonite. Haven't run across one yet. They don't give workshops and seminars or retreats. They don't do any of that.
They just give. They just donate to whoever they want to donate to. But see, the point is what you just talked about and mentioned. That's a lesson itself. I mean, that ought to create people that really want to be motivated. Because, see, we're living basically, personally, I think this personally, this is my opinion, we're living a lie in behind the other things, okay? And when the lie comes out to ever be found, it was nothing there anyway. That's just like me. It took me 30 years. I never mentioned this to you either, Austin Lee. It took me 30 years before I really knew what I wanted in life. And I have read all kinds of books, yoga, Hinduism, Mormon and all that. But it all comes down to the reality of find yourself, and everybody else will find you. It's not the people that have changed. It's you, yourself, attitude has changed. And that's what people need to realize to be a better person, to live better in this life, because I don't know what's beyond the other life. I'm going to make the most here what I know about. And just look at the things that you, like you mentioned about the Rolls Royces, the Lamborghinis and all these expensive cars, living in $1 million, $2 or $3 million home now, which is hardly nothing anymore. Also eating the best food, caviar and stuff out there. Is that really you personally? Is that what you want to do with your life? If so, fine. But just be ready to deal with the stress if you're not set up to be able to eliminate it. And that's what kills a lot of people down the road. Really does. I mean, when you can find yourself, you know you got the key to riches right there. And most people, 97% of the people don't understand what I just said. That's pitiful. It really is. And another thing, you can think about this. When you're in school, when you're in grammar school, middle school, and college, do they ever teach you how to get rich or be comfortable with your life? Think about
There's no bachelor's degree in that. Two good examples would be, let's take the National NBA, National Basketball Association or NFL National Football League, there are no, and let's just take a look at the coaches. I'm not even going to concentrate on the players.
Mm-hmm.
There's no bachelor's degree on how to become a coach on a professional level or a collegiate level, and a lot of those people make six and seven figures a year. There's
easily,
no bachelor's easily. Program in the United States at all, and there are quite a number of colleges and universities, but there is, a matter of fact, Steve Jobs, the late Steve Jobs, or Mark Zuckerberg, or Bill, what's his name, Bill Gates.
Mm-hmm.
There was I don't know what it is now, but there was no bachelor's program on the college, master's, or doctorate level on how to set up a website, because Facebook is nothing but a glorified website.
That's what it is. That's exactly what it is.
But Mark Zuckerberg did not take a – he does not have a bachelor's degree. He does not have a bachelor of arts or a bachelor of science degree in setting up a website, particularly to the degree that he did with what do you call
yes.
it, Facebook.
Yes. Okay. And another thing, think about this, Lee. Now, okay, you look at the Mormon, look at the Mennonites, look at the Amish. Even the Mormons have some things. I don't believe in their religion, but it's some things I watch. Now, they can take canned goods, they can store them for a year or more. You know, they never run out of food. They have a pantry set up to store canned goods and whatever until, just say they get in a storm, they can't go out of the house for maybe 3 or 4 months or a year. They got that much stored in a pantry, okay? And another thing, look at the Amish. Okay, now, do you see any websites set up by Amish?
No.
Why don't you think so?
They keep it within the community.
That's the point. They don't have to commercialize their products to buy their products to keep their pockets where they want to be. It's the community. That's what keeps it up. And you mentioned about all the Amish different, not only Yoder, you're right. It's all Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. That's the biggest Amish place around right now. And a lot of people live right there among them and don't even know that, see. So, really,
yeah, a lot of people look at a lot of people with a Western lifestyle, American lifestyle, they look at the horse. They don't want to drive horse. The first thing, number one, they don't want to live in a rural area. Okay. So,
that's right.
And then you look at if you listen to the words, in other words, you know, they want to go to a Whole Foods. They want to go to a Wegmans. They want to drive this car. They want to, you know, that car. They want to wear these type of clothes. And if you listen to the typical American, their vocabulary is a consumer-based vocabulary.
You know, it's a saying again about that, Lee. And to me, one of the perfect things is a credit card. They'll tell you buy now and pay later. You sure is going to pay later. I mean, so when you get a credit card, and maybe you got a limit $200,000 or $300,000, whatever. They'll say, I noticed one thing, what they'll do right around Christmas time and holidays, they'll start having these early sale pushes where they'll say, you got your credit card, and we'll give you more limit if you buy right now. What do you think they're telling you, man? They're telling you to stay in debt. I got credit cards right now. I never use them, okay? But it drives them crazy when you don't, because the name of the game is debt, okay? Is debt.
Well, it's interesting you said that. Last night I stepped outside because I have a solar light that I had to retrieve. I got it outside right now charging. But I stepped outside, and one of my neighbors that lives across the street, their front lawn, September the 20th today. Okay. No, not September the 20th, October the 20th. Okay. Halloween isn't even here yet. Okay, that's about, 10, 11 days away. They have on their front lawn, where you can't miss it, their Christmas decorations out already. So, and Christmas is a straight-up consumer holiday, unless you're thinking like an Amish or a Mennonite family, where they make Christmas gifts to sell to consumers.
Yes, that's right. Okay, it's the opposite. Okay, where I look at people now, though, Lee. I've been and done what I've done in my life. You know, it's sad to see those people. They're lost in something that's not reality. Reality is staying out of debt. That lessens the stress, the everyday living of stress. It prolongs your life too. It can. And so, the point is the name of the game again. We don't want to talk to you if you don't buy nothing. We'll give you a credit card if we want you to use it. That's what cop.
Right.
That's a cop out, Lee. It's a habit. It's a failure to realize what it's all about, and they're not doing this out of niceness. They're doing it out of priceless, okay?
Right. Albert, hold on a minute. We got a caller here before the time gets away from us.
Okay.
We got Albert Lee and Delmar America on here today. And let's see. Let's go to area code 314. Your mic is open.
Yeah, L.A., I've been home since 10 o'clock. Me and Albert, I was supposed to tell him about Africa.
Well, you got plenty of time to do it.
Hey, I had to go to event. You know, another thing, too, let me tell you, and Elver tell you, too. You got to be consistent on your time when you're doing something, especially when you're doing business with other people. It's very, very important that you do. I got workers. The clock starts for them at 7 o'clock. If they get there at 7:10, I dock them 10 minutes. Go ahead.
I can't hear him, Lee. I'm sorry. I really want to hear what he's saying.
I don't know how to fix that.
I know, but that's
because I hear him clear.
I
hear him
still
in my
head.
He got such good stuff to say. I want to hear it. See.
Wait a minute. I close one of the mics.
Okay.
Okay. Go. I'm gonna close my mic too. Pianki, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah. Can you hear me now, Albert?
Yeah, I hear you. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was telling LA that when you're dealing with a institution that require on participation of others, you got to be prostitute with your time and so forth, because you can't be up there talking to yourself. If you're going to do that, you might as well just have a conference call on the telephone. It's cheaper than
one
of these outlets.
That's right. That's right.
And I see some people on Blog Talk Radio, and I tune into their show, and you know what they're doing? They playing songs on the radio.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's the young, I call it young media, where they really creating forefront road for the future, because it seemed like everything we learned growing up or during our period of time, it's all getting out obsolete, outdated now, see. But listen to you, what you just said. You absorbing the time factor. You absorbing what's changing. But how many people like you, though? Think about it. See?
Well, yeah. And And then when they have somebody, you know, they have a show and they have a caller call in, and they'll hold that caller for about a half hour as if they're trying to make them listen to what it is they're talking about,
mm-hmm.
where the caller may be critical of mm-hmm. what they're talking about, and as if they're on a punishment. But
it's junk.
Anyway.
It's junk. It is.
Yeah, anyway, beyond it. And I want to make mention, too, of a person that's in the news today, and that's Kanye West.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've been listening.
Yeah, I've been following that. Yeah, I've been following that, yes.
You know, I think that Kanye, and what he says is nothing new, because we've heard, at least I've heard it before, I'm sure you heard it before, too, about the Jews. There's two elements of Jews. You got Jews, the religion, then you got Jews, the club. You just got through talking about the Amish. There's the Amish, the religion, the Mennonite religion, old German. Then you got the club. And the club is when you have groups of people that comes together on any particular issue. It can be two people, three. It can be around a table. And I've sat around all of them. And they're discussing things. They invite you to participate if you want to. You know, one thing that is a requirement anytime that I sat around a table, I had to show them financials, of course. And you had to have your accountant to draw that up and certify it. Because they want to know that you're able to hold your own in anything that you pledge to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they also want to know to make sure that ain't nobody chasing you all over town for money.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they're chasing you all over town for money, then eventually they're going to be chasing after the group's money too. And did you know another thing that they ask and look at positively, Elbert, is whether or not you marry. I don't know if you've experienced that before. But those joint ventures are concerned whether or not you're married.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for obvious reason, because if they have an event, they don't want you looking at their wives.
There you go. That's true. It makes
That's
sense.
One of
yeah.
them. But marriage also is a liability, and it has demonstrated that you're able to hold a responsibility, especially if it's a long-term marriage.
Mm-hmm.
But people would be surprised. Then, of course,
you
go ahead and do your day.
Yeah, cutting in on your smartness there. You know what I've always practiced, and I know it's hard sometimes. I look at each religion, whatever it is. I look at each culture, whatever it is, as being, you find your way and I'll find mine. And I don't care about, I'm not going to worry about what you doing or what you're not doing. And personally, I don't believe in, you know, just knocking each religion or culture. I don't believe in that. I'm getting this on the podcast so it'll be there. But I don't believe in that. I mean, like I said, each person run their own lives. Each person say what they want to say. But I look at each culture as a miracle to be able to live in their culture and their way of living and to be successful in what they do. More power to them. And I'm not trying to be blatant about it. It's just that I don't dwell on culturals, because like you talk about Kanye West, I don't go into that, see, because I mean everybody put here for a reason on this planet, but everybody has different ways of thinking, and I'm not gonna knock that, but I just don't personally get involved with that. See, always been that way. Lee
well,
can tell you.
Yeah, you know, as far as he's concerned. He's said some things as far as the control that lies within certain entities that you tie yourself up into.
Mm-hmm.
And like I just got through telling you.
He's a billionaire. They say he's a billionaire acting like that. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
He's that on paper. He's that on paper, at least. There's a difference between what shows up on paper and a net worth column, because that changes every minute.
Yes, it does. It does. Mm-hmm.
It changes literally every minute. It doesn't wait till the end of the month. It changes every minute.
Right. And you know all
you
I want,
services.
You know all I want people to
money.
Do. Yeah, all I want people
mm-hmm.
to do is to look at themselves in the mirror and see that they're great people. They're miracles. But you know that's a hard thing to get people to see. And
well, he's getting drugged down. You know
well,
who's
yeah,
dragging him down?
That's the point, okay?
Yeah, but you know who's dragging him down? Seemingly
I
to
like
me.
To know that. Who's that, Pion?
It's the people that he came up with
mm-hmm.
in these industries.
Well,
you got the hosts. You got other rappers. And... you know, you got organizations that's looking for
power. Power is what it is. Mm-hmm.
Looking for somebody they can consider power because without leaning on somebody else, they don't have it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can be a black. You can be a black billionaire. That's a perfect example. You're still black. You're still black. Okay. But that's what I was saying to you earlier. I've come to the conclusion. It ain't. It's not about the race or the culture, the color. It's about the mind. Can the mind absorb, and can the mind can do what other people of the other nationalities can it do that? Are you able to function with your mind like they do? That's the danger right there. That's dangerous.
Well, they all have those problems. Don't make no difference what your skin color is.
Yeah.
If you are performing in a certain arena, you're out there performing on your own merit.
There you go.
You're not performing on somebody else's merit.
There you go.
You're performing on your merit.
How many people can we get to do this, though?
It's the law of nutrition. It's not meant for everybody.
I wanted you to say that. I wanted you to say that.
It's not meant for everybody. And see, my judge is the conversation that people have.
There you go.
And I'm going to give you a prime example. And I'm going to talk about blacks. Whites do it the same, too. You just got to know what you're listening at. It's not centered to any particular skin color or any particular ethnic group. The only thing that varies is how it's applied in different ethnic groups, because all ethnic groups are not the same.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
But when you hear, you know, you made mention about things that you can learn in a school. Well, school is not necessarily a classroom, because you got people who can't afford to get into those classrooms or can't get in because they don't qualify to get in. Then they have education comes from other places. Like places like the barbershop
mm-hmm.
and the barbershop conversations that go on.
Oh, yeah.
So when you somebody approach you and they start using verbiage that you have assumed and probably experienced and know of that was obtained in classroom barbershop, then you can pretty much determine their overall extent.
Their view. You're right.
Their capability. Like, for instance, somebody comes to you, and I'm talking about blacks again. When you hear them, and I got the one guy who's a school teacher. He thinks he dropped out of school teaching. And he comes up through the Nation of Islam. And I can hear the things that he's saying about, yeah, the devil's done this, and so on and so on and so on. You understand what I'm saying? You know what I mean? Now, although you don't agree to that, but you don't openly tell him that, you don't agree to that. Now, if they're young enough, I will. I say, man, that's a bunch of bull crap. But what they do, they immediately tell you, indicate to you, what realm that they're operating in.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how to deal with them.
Mm-hmm. I dealt with them. What you're talking about, I had to deal with them when my son was younger, living here at home. You know, he was finding himself at the time. And, again, he had to realize he got involved with it. He had a friend that was a Muslim. He was that, okay, and he kept asking me, Dad, how do I weigh this? He said, I'm confused. He told me that. I said, well, what you do, you read and see, do that apply to you? And I said, then if it don't apply to you, don't push yourself to accept it.
What were they doing? Fishing?
Huh?
What were they doing with him? Fishing? He got caught up in the net.
They were trying to recruit him. Yeah, they were trying to recruit him.
There you go.
But you know, let me say this. This is my opinion. I mean, it's just my opinion. Now, my wife is white. My wife is white. My kids are mixed. You know what it's telling me, the way I visualize, it's showing the world, personally, is no color. Because if you got a mixed child where it's black, white, what color? How can you separate the colors right there? And I've noticed also on television for lately, these advertisements, these commercials, that's all that's on there now, is mixed kids. It's telling me personally, because it's been 50-something years since I've been married, okay? It's telling me that the world is changing. They don't want to be classified as black, white, whatever, yellow, Indian, or whatever. And another thing I picked up on lately, the Indians are standing up more and more. I mean, I'm talking about the tribal Indians, you know, not the Indian sect, but the tribal Indians. The reservation.
Native Americans, that you're talking about? Okay.
Yes. Uh-huh. That's the way I look at it. And what...
The Native Americans are pretty much ethnocentric groups, too.
Well, you couldn't. I can't hear
not you. All the tribes, but some.
Now,
they kick the blacks out of there.
But it's the thing to me. It's a time factor where everything is coming to the forefront. Okay, for instance, again, like how many minorities did you see or can talk the way we're talking now 60, 50 years ago? I've seen history myself personally. I've seen it. But now it's getting more freer to discuss different things that most blacks have really became and become aware of, okay? And I'm getting on the financial part of it. The financial end is, when I was first starting, I never seen as many blacks really into what we're talking about, real estate or trying to live better in their lives, because they weren't taught that. But each generation.
Well, you had some, but you didn't have many. I don't know how many there were, but I heard the conversation. I got a brother that's got about 7 or 8 of his sons are millionaires.
Oh yeah.
So you had some, but that you knew of, but you may not knew of a lot of them, and
mm-hmm.
then you multiply that amongst other people, you know, in
the
country.
Well, I was a pioneer. I was a pioneer when I got married. That's another thing I made the history of. I don't like to bring that up a lot, but my kids and my relatives, they all know that, because when we got married, my wife and I, that's another, it was, matter of fact, 68 was it, wasn't that the first year that apartheid or something like that became legal? It was legal to, I don't know, do you keep up with history?
You talking about in South Africa or the marriage laws in this country?
Yeah, well, the laws in this country are related to that.
What you mean, love is very Virginia?
Yeah. He's talking about the Virginia case. Yeah, the Loving case
that was,
in Virginia.
That's right. That was in 68, okay? And so we got married in 70, 2 years later. That's when I got married.
Yeah, but they had blacks been marrying whites in this country. I mean, look at Jack Johnson. He's married
You know yourself. It's been going on, though, for years, even in slavery, but it wasn't brought out.
It was up to the states is what it was, and then the courts erroneously ruled on that because that's still a state issue. But I know what you're talking about.
But see, I'm saying. I've seen change in a lot of it since I've been around here. And I've seen a lot of change. See, I've seen a lot of it in all phases of living, all phases of life. I've seen it in attitudes. I've seen it in growth. I've seen it in financial. I've seen it in cultural mixing. I've seen that. And so the way I look at it is, we all make, the bottom line, what I'm saying is, we all make history, we just don't realize it, that's all. And the whole thing is...
Yeah, given that, why do you think there's so much talk along the lines with people constantly saying, blacks need to do this, blacks, we need, as if they're asking for segregation,
resegregation. Right, I agree with you.
Is that an error of... little consequences?
I think that's a good question you brought up. I think
wait a minute, I used the wrong word. Is that an error of little confidence of in themselves? Not consequences,
that,
but confidence in themselves, individuals.
That's what I was getting ready to say, and that's what the problem is. They want it, but they don't know how to go get it or feel afraid to go get it. My sister, for example, what you just said, my sister, when I first got married, was jealous of that. She would always have white girls and stuff staying overnight over there at the house we grew up. But when I got married there, she felt like she was left out, okay? But the point, what I'm saying is, too, anyone can be and do what they want to do if they put their mind on it and quit looking narrowly on what they don't see, what they think they see. Live it. Expose yourself to all education, knowledge, or whatever it is, cultures. You have to be interested. It's just like a job. You have to study that. Am I right? You got to know that. But most people don't want
to
do that.
Yeah, they do.
And that's
teach
where,
you how to
that's
become...
where the failure come in, seriously, in our
yeah,
race.
They do teach you how... They do teach you how to become millionaires in school. You just got to be studying the right thing.
There you go.
I'll tell you something else. They was teaching coding for free at some locations around St. Louis, especially at the NAACP office there on Delmar and Newstead.
But how many people observe it? How many people are interested?
Let me tell you this. It was people that was coming from around the state and outstate.
I believe that.
Rather than those who live in the neighborhood.
In your own backyard. That's what I'm saying. In your own backyard. See? Now, Lee, like your program. Are you listening, Lee? Lee.
Yeah. I just muted myself. Yeah, I'm listening.
Okay, like you, for instance. Now, you doing a very good service. You got a podcast. You got an educational podcast. Now, how many blacks are listening? Be truthful. How many people are really listening to you?
You really can't tell with podcasts because you got people from different countries and then you got different time zones. So I really couldn't tell you how many do.
Well,
I produced other people's podcasts. It all depends on the topic. Now, like if we're having a discussion like we have on here occasionally, like reparations, the participants will probably be all black or African American.
Okay.
But occasionally, you'll have a white person that will come on and ask questions or give comment or whatever. And then on occasion, I'll bring on a white guest to speak about various, you know, various topics like time banking. And I haven't done that one in a while, but stuff like that. So, because it's this country, actually the whole world, the way I look at it, is very tribal. So some people can go in and out of different tribes, and some people just prefer to stick to their tribe, whatever that might be.
Right. You're right. Segregation is what it is. Just saying it down low and clear, it's segregate, okay? And that's what's keeping us back. We're losing out on knowledge. We're losing out on things that we need to know because we want to segregate. And that's why you have to be a venturesome person, challenging person. You want to learn all about everything that means things. But now you don't want to learn about
something. Yeah, you're talking about an individual basis. Now, there are groups that work within groups. That's nothing, that form, I guess you can say, enclave. Egg in St. Louis, they got a Russian enclave. Mm-hmm. Up on the hill, they got an Italian enclave.
Mm-hmm.
Down around one area, they got a Polish enclave. So they do operate. But it's the ability of individuals in the group that comes from the group to venture off. There's a good book on that. It's called Tribes, T-R-I-B-E-S, by Jewel Coleman. Its subtitle is How Race, Ethnicity, and Religion Determine Success. And
right.
It talks about the Chinese. It talks about the British because we know what they've done throughout history. We see what the Chinese is doing throughout history. We talk about the Indians from India, not Indians as we know today. I think the Indians that we know today had their time, and their time has passed. And that's the way the world is. With these groups, they have their time. Their time comes, then their time passes. When the curtains of time open up and call your name, and if you don't step forward, then it's going to close, then open up and call another group's name. And that group that we see today is the Asians. Asians
right.
are making strides.
That's right.
Before
That's
him, right. you've seen the British. The British were making strides. If you go back far enough, should I say, you see what other groups came out of the northeast corner of Africa that made strides, and other groups in that area that made strides. So that's just the way the world is.
Yeah,
and that's the way it's going to be.
But, you know, cutting in on you, beautiful what you're saying, but the way I look at it, too, is we as blacks that have been underprivileged, supposedly, we should try to learn as much as we can, when we can, and how we can. Because knowledge, it don't change you, but it makes you think, okay? You change by your motivation. That's what changes you. But the knowledge is there when it gives you an opportunity. That's like you going to court, you're sitting in on a trial. You listen to what the people say, right? That's the same thing. But we don't do that enough. You know, then again, we have all these wars, fighting and stuff over here like Ukraine and Russia. Why are they doing all this? Now, I can say Ukraine don't have – you can't blame Ukraine. You got to blame Russia. Why are
well,
we doing
I think
all
the
this?
Other, I think the opposite. I think you can't blame Russia. You got to blame those
well,
that's influenced
that's
in Ukraine.
Opinion. That's the opinion. That's right. I agree. And I respect
you.
Believe me now, that's another thing, the way I am. I might not agree with you, but I'm not going to disagree with you to the point of it's not worth that. See, that's how you
still
learn.
You still got Nazi elements that exist in the Ukraine and have been a natural-born enemy to Russia throughout the years, as well as, you know, coming up through World War II. But then again, Nikhil Khrushchev was a Ukrainian.
Well, I think Putin's losing ground, too, I think, personally. He's at the age now, I think he's 70. I don't think he thinks he's accomplished nothing. Well, I mean, if you're going to kill up millions of people, I mean, you could be another Hitler. you know. But that's my opinion.
Well, he's not going to let NATO put missiles on his border within 400 miles of his capital.
Mm-hmm.
Don't blacks complain about
black
that
king.
All the time?
Over there, I mean, by the black sea somewhere over there, isn't it?
No, he's not going to let them put missiles on their border. The United States, during the Kennedy era, let Russia put missiles in Cuba.
But see, what the reason why I brought that up now is something to think about, okay? But why can't we, the bottom line is what I brought it up for, why can't we think about ourselves and don't worry about Russia and Putin and all of them or whatever? Let's get into ourselves. Let's worry about how we going to make ourselves better and have a decent, comfortable way of living. That's what we owe.
Well, as far as blacks concerned, as a talked about group, I agree with you. But there are concerns that is a group that is worried about that because it will play out to their interest. You know, you as a business person going to go to Russia and open up no business.
No.
It ain't going to happen.
No.
Bianchi. Delmar, are you there?
Yeah,
oh,
he's
wait
there.
A minute. I got to open up.
Oh, you talking
I got
to
open up his mic. No,
yeah,
hold
I'm
up.
Here.
Delmar,
yeah,
you there?
I was busy.
Delmar, I want you to share.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, Delmar and I, we speak every morning. Delmar is up in Chicago, and he has a morning routine. Delmar, share with him your experiences at McDonald's when you go walk there in the morning.
Yeah, I and my part of my schedule walk, McDonald's within the walking distance that I schedule. It opened up at 6 a.m. That's the scheduled time. It's owned by Hispanics. Used to be owned by blacks. And sometimes that place go over up to 9 in the morning because they don't have enough employees to run it. Drive-thru's always open, but they don't open the lobby yet because they don't have employees there to run it. And it's ridiculous because we know why. It's not a mystery. Everybody knows why. Now, Hispanics run it. They own it. And if they would have put all, in my opinion, if they put all Hispanics in there, it would all be running. I've seen them when they stand there short and finally a Hispanic person shows up. They only need one more person, maybe two more people show up, and they open the whole place up. But they can't get people to work. And this is not a nasty neighborhood. I mean, this is 95th and Stony Island, one of the primary area of the black community, right off the edge of what is called Inglewood. Very upscale, so to speak. But, again, to make the point, yes, they not open it up every morning, on time, sometimes 7:30, 8:30, even as late as 9, because they don't have employees who will come to work. And they can
Delmar, could you give us the demographic that should be working in there or that could be working in there at that time slot?
Well, I heard that it was black dominated because it began at one time. It was an all-black crew in there. And if I say that,
okay.
Hispanics have bought it. They purchased
the reason why I asked Delmar that is because, number one, Chicago is a, what do they call it, it's a sanctuary city, and then, if people have been keeping up with the news, you have a lot of people south of the border that they're being allowed into the country, and sooner or later, and Chicago's one of the places where they've been going. It's not the only place, but it's one of the places. So, once again, at the title of this podcast at the beginning, what do the Amish and Mennonite teach their children? Because, see, if certain tribes don't teach their children, a few short years from now, we're going to be reading about so-and-so. We're going to hear a victim story from certain communities.
You know something about
that. What do you say, Bianchi?
You shouldn't be expecting Now, of course, we, you know, one thing is assumptions, but you shouldn't be expecting to see blacks working in that type of employment anyway at this point in time. I mean, that should be a stepping stone, but not a place you want to reside.
Right.
Very long, especially for the rest of your life.
Right.
And I often used to note that when I would go outside of St. Louis in the immediate area, and or should I say over in South St. Louis, I have to stop by McDonald's to get my favorite snack at the time, which was a chocolate shake. And it would be a whole black crew in a white area. And I said, there's something wrong with this picture. But you got to ask yourself, why are blacks predominantly in those type of positions
mm-hmm.
for so long?
That's true.
Now, I can understand a part-time driver helped by books and school and so on, so on, so on. You would expect that. But at some point in time, you would have to get out of that
mm-hmm.
realm of position, especially in this country, because I've never seen Nigerians working in a McDonald's.
Right.
And people say, well, how can you tell? Well, I can tell.
Oh, hold it now. Oh, hold it, Pianchi. Now, I have, but let me give you the backstory on it. This is right outside of Washington, D.C. It's on the border of Eastern Avenue and New Hampshire Avenue in PG County, Maryland, D.C. Now, I walked into this McDonald's just some years ago, and everybody mm-hmm. in that McDonald's, every crew person, every cook, all the managers were Nigerian. Why? Because Nigerians bought that McDonald's. They bought it.
They probably owned the place, and they was training their kids to go out and venture in the other franchises that they was going to open up like that are being trained in order to go back home and get in the same line of business.
Good observation.
We're in agreement on that.
Again, that comes from what you've been saying all morning, a different mental culture is what they've been taught. They don't come over here to find jobs. They come over to get educated and then have a business or something. Whereas Americans, we have programmed our children to go out and find a job for life.
Right. We can fly.
That's the training.
We can fly. We can fly as much as and where and higher as we ever want to if we, like you said, buddy, put our minds to it. Okay, because, see, I was raised in a similar situation, too, okay? Where I lived in, when I was growing up, it was nothing but a black. It was Lee family, but it was all a whole block. And it was nothing but blacks lived around West Fresno. That's all it was. But in my mind, I was dreaming, I got to fly over the cuckoo's nest. That's what you're saying. And if you can do it. But see, we were just talking about it earlier. People program their minds to stay where they think they're free. And it's a trap. That's what it is.
According to the business assistant, and I think the last one, it come out every 10 years, blacks had about 2.2 million businesses, maybe a little bit more than 2.4. But they only hired like 900,000 employees. Now, when you look at other groups that may have 1.5 million business, they'll have over 4.5 million employees. You see the difference there.
Mm-hmm. And they, it's a big difference. And in certain neighborhoods, have you noticed though, I know in California, they have these mostly minority and ethnic groups that lives in the area. They're not going with the minorities and groups that to work in. They just picking people as capable, they think. Because like he said,
well, you got to look at what kind of business do these people have.
Yes, that's right.
Right? Then when you further do the investigation on that.
What are you trying to tell me, Lee, about that subject and your guess? What are you telling us directly?
What I'm trying to say is you got to look at what type of business that they What kind of business is there in it?
That shouldn't be a retirement, but to some people it is. But that shouldn't be a retirement business. It should be a stepping stone. But most people get lost in their feeling. They don't want to challenge. They don't want to go out there and fail, they think. Well, they're failing on the job because they stand there, but they don't realize that. Okay.
I've seen McDonald's have a open for people to come get applications and do and fulfill what they need to have, like you just got through mentioned, the guy up in Chicago. They have kids standing in the high school standing in line. They have adults standing in line. Now, something's wrong with that picture. But that's the reality of what you see. You got adults, middle-aged adults, competing for jobs that you would expect high schoolers.
That's right. That's right.
To be occupied.
Right. I agree. I agree. Agree 100% with that. Because my son was one of those too. He worked for McDonald's because my nephew worked for. He was a manager for McDonald's years ago, but. I taught my son, you never stay in a position that you're not satisfied with, and you can't meet your obligations. So he went on and he worked there for about a year or two, and then he just said, "Dad, I gotta go to school and get my degree in law," and that motivated him. But that wasn't motivating him to stay there. It was a means to the end. Okay. Then my nephew that hired him. He's no longer there either, but he worked there a long time. They were giving him good bonuses and all that, giving all that to him. But you got to look at it in a different way. That's just like, are you going to live like this until you get in your 80s or 70s or 60s or whatever? And it's a means to the end. That's all it should be. To me, it is. Now, I don't know about other people.
Well, let me comment real quick. When Piyaki mentioned, the Nigerians buying the McDonald's and using it as a training ground, that type of thinking, and Piyaki, I'm glad you brought up that example, because that's the first time I've heard of, I would like to see some type of African-American, black, whatever you want to call it, black American, do the same thing, because that's really, in my opinion, that's thinking outside of the box.
Yeah,
that's thinking outside of the box.
Well, it is thinking outside the box, but you got to listen to what you're saying, because if you got a population of 39 or 40 million blacks, and a third of them are going to be kids under 18.
That's right.
So you're talking about 10, 20, you're talking about 13 million, say 15, a little under 15 million that's going to be in that type of entity, because you got those that's over 65 ain't going to be doing this stuff. You're only going to have a certain segment within your population. That's gonna, everybody ain't going to be doing that.
Uh-huh.
And then, too, what I hear people saying is that you're looking for individual millionaires to look up to.
Right.
Because
everybody
that worked for the company ain't going to be a millionaire because they wouldn't be working for the company.
That's right. That's right.
You're only looking at a handful of people within that population that's in that age range that's going to be fooled with something like that.
The biggest thing
that this ethnic group can do is educate their children. The kids not being educated.
That's right. I agree with that. 100%.
The kids not being educated for anything, especially that which is in need and going to be needed in the future.
That's right. That's right.
Delmar, you had a comment, Delmar?
Yes, I want to have.
Delmar, you had a comment.
A closing comment. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. As Solomon said, this is conclude the whole matter. Mr. Lee, I want to thank you for your knowledge and your bringing on and sharing. And you started out with the answer. You started out with, can you hear me now? Can anybody hear me?
I can't hear him.
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right, we can hear you, Delma. I'm going to mute my mic so you'll come in clear.
Okay. I want to thank your guest for his knowledge and expertise we brought to it. And my point is, the answer is in what you shared was about the Amish and what they taught, and that's all family-based. And until we recognize that kind of potential as a way of helping any group of people, we're going to continue to just talk about what's going on. But if we don't apply what we know that works, and what those people are practicing works, there's no denying it. It's not smoke and mirrors. They're not faking it. And all the things that he has said and repeated and shared about the Amish and other people, they are doing what, if people in America don't turn to that, because this, you hear people talk about the American experiment. Well, the experiment has failed. It just hasn't manifested itself yet. As I think Mr. Lee has said, eventually the people who are going to get past this whole epoch in American history will be those who rediscover the power of families, of people coming together, helping each other, not trying to keep pace with this free enterprise, greed-driven culture we're in, which is based upon debt, and therefore that, by design, by God's law, is going to fail. It's already failed. It just hadn't come manifest yet. So if we're going to be saying, what can we do, anybody do, go back to what we see that other groups are doing, regardless of what race or whatever it is they work, and that is people are coming together, working together, recognizing what works and what doesn't. And as you say, they're not trying to make it a campaign to get everybody into it or bite everybody in. They're doing it among themselves, and it's working, and it will continue.